All right, good evening. Tonight is the second night in, I'm not sure if there's going to be a third part, we'll see after tonight, but certainly this is the second night on the, what are called the five aggregates form, this form that contains both our body and our mind. You know, in Buddhist practice, it's Nama-Rupa, it's considered to be a completely, fully integrated system. Much like pre-Buddhist thought in Indian philosophy, which didn't make the Cartesian distinction. So when we talk about form, we're talking about a unified system and wisdom being infused in the entire form. It's not the Cartesian split of wisdom is located in a particular part of the body only, in the brain or in the mind or whatever we want to call it. And I think we know just by experience this is true, because we have these experiences of physical motion, or you're getting some kind of deep massage work, or there's a number of ways this arises, but there will be something with your body, and then you can feel the release in a part of the body, and a whole series of experiences or a key experiences releases, and a lot of emotion around that, and wisdom arises from that. So the first is form. The next are the three things that arise at the moment of contact of a sense door and a sense object. So, the ear and the sound of a bell, the mind and a thought arising in the mind and a recognition that the thought is there, a smell, a taste, a sensation, any part of the body. And three things simultaneously arise at this moment of contact with a sense door and a sense object, and that is, first, consciousness. Before that, before I hit the bell, there's no consciousness of the bell, right? So from Buddhist perspective, these are separate consciousnesses. They're all happening almost simultaneously, but they are actually considered separate, and that's a key idea to get a hold of, because it translates specifically into the meditation techniques to examine this. It's not that we're trying to take apart a unified consciousness. We're actually trying to see a series of very closely linked different types of consciousness, each having its own value and implication. So there's consciousness, there's perception that arises simultaneously or nearly simultaneously, and perception in this sense is the basic ability of the mind to distinguish an experience that it is having from another experience. So, I hit this, I know that I'm hearing a bell as opposed to a car or a bird. And I know that I'm hearing this and I'm not hearing a spoon. It's linked to a general body of knowledge. Okay? So it's this immediate thing that the mind begins to do of distinguishing. So there's a contact, consciousness, perception, and then the third thing is feeling, the feeling tone. And in Buddhist practice, this is a feeling tone, or a feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral that's associated with the consciousness and the perception that has just arisen. Okay? And where that comes from, the question always is, well, why does that happen? And It comes from the fifth of the five aggregates, which is mental or volitional formations. That's what they're traditionally called. And they are fundamentally, I mean, for shorthand, they are fundamentally deep and deeply embedded habits of mind, emotional reactivity, ways of thinking, ways of believing or understanding the world, or how we think we understand the world, beliefs. Many of them are, the majority of them are so deep we don't even know that they're there. And they're influencing us all the time. And then we start practicing, and you start to see that there's this whole subscript that is driving and directing and coloring and influencing our reactions to things. So that feeling tone that arises with consciousness and perception at that moment of contact is colored, pleasant or unpleasant, by these prior experiences, these prior habits, or there is nothing about that experience, or nothing in some traditions they call where these habits or mental formation or volitional formations are, they call it a storehouse. They actually use that term. And so there's nothing in that storehouse of prior experience in this lifetime, or depending on what you believe, in a prior lifetime, that when it connects with the particular thing that's arisen, generates any kind of reaction. In other words, there's no karma, there's no prior pattern of experience that it is connected or related to that experience that has arisen. So that's the start of it. Those are the five formations and what the Buddha said. And what this whole sutta is about, and this whole set of practices, is, well, what is the problem with those five things? It sounds, well, okay, those all sound very helpful to understand that, right? I mean, understand how consciousness arises, and to understand how perception is influenced negatively or positive, how it's colored, you know, and like if we can do that, we can do something about it. And that's true, and that's another practice. Okay? This is not a doing practice in the sense of, you know, you can think of doing in two different ways. There's doing in the sense of we learn a meditative technique, and then we are actually doing that technique when we're meditating, right? So like, we're using something as an anchor. When our mind wanders, we recognize that. We bring that back. We try to develop discernment, more and more refined discernment of the mind states and emotional states. So those are meditative processes, techniques, strategies. It doesn't matter what we call them. Okay, so we're applying those. So that's a positive form of doing. So you all know that there's kind of this pejorative negative relationship to the term doing in Buddhism. And what that's talking about is trying to fix something, to solve something, to change it. And there are specific strategies and techniques to do that. But the starting place for deep meditative work is not changing something, is not fixing it or trying to fix it. Because until we have taken sufficient time just to be with it, just to sit there with it and see it over and over again, you know, what it feels like, where it comes from, you know, what its origin is, what its feeling tone is, how it ends, what are the consequences of each of these, we'll never figure out how to deal with it on a long-term basis. And this is the key point, because this sutta is about long-term work, not about short-term work. Okay? So many of the meditation techniques and the mindfulness techniques can be very, very powerful. You know, this week I looked at a couple of online mindfulness programs, and they're all doing in the second sense. And I'm not saying that these programs don't have value, or actually skillfully working with things isn't a value. It is. But these programs are all about doing. You know, it's about how you can be a better employee, or how you can be a better this or a better that, and somebody's leading with that, and then there's all these supposed mindfulness techniques to learn how to do that. That's great, but that's never going to result in the kind of long-term work or the long-term solutions to suffering. I mean, there's all kinds of short-term things we can do, but the if you think about your life, I feel actually fairly confident in saying this. Even if I don't know you, that if we honestly look at our lives, the things that have been causing us to suffer have been causing us to suffer for as long as we can remember. And if something is that deeply embedded and related to a mental or volitional formation, there's no weekend program you're going to go to, or a single retreat, or anything else that is going to resolve that. This is about long-term work, you know, day by day, year by year, lifetime by lifetime, and actually experience by experience. Because with every single experience, we're doing one of three things. We are reinforcing pre-existing and negative or unskillful or unhealthy karma or habits. We are engaging something in a way through mindfulness where we are developing or reinforcing a new skillful, healthful pattern. Or we're just unconscious, which actually fits into the first one. Because if we're unconscious, there's no way the chances of our being skillful are very small. You know, it's going to be by accident. So this whole, what is the problem about the five aggregates and the problem from the Buddhist perspective was that this is where we most deeply attach. And attachment leads to identification. And, once attachment gets hooks in you and it starts moving towards identification even a little bit, it changes the way we're relating to experience. We start moving into a place of separation. We start thinking, reacting, feeling from a place of self-interest or self-centeredness. The way we start relating to things becomes self-absorbed. We begin engaging in all kinds of manipulation, frequently not even realizing it, because the manipulation is coming from attachment or identification. So we're manipulating things to obtain what we're attached to, or reinforce it, or support it. And if we're identified, then we're manipulating to do things that are consistent with the needs and desires and objections of that identification. So, I mean, that is the classic discussion from a Buddhist perspective of, well, why are the aggregates a problem? Because we cling to them, and we cling to them as self. And then once that happens, the way we're relating just to all of our experience just immediately shifts in a moment. The moment of contact immediately shifts, and then everything changes. So I was thinking about that on the way over, and I was so interested in what I just said. Because I think this is so interesting. And I mean, it is so profound. And it is at the core, I mean, it is at the absolute core of all of our suffering. You know, because the second noble truth that the Buddha laid out was that the origin of suffering is craving, right? You know, and craving includes its desire and aversion, right? And ignorance in craving. But your mind can be craving something, but if attachment doesn't take place, there's no suffering. If there's no attachment arising from the craving, there's no suffering. There's just craving that's happening, okay? So that the mind hasn't constricted to lock down, to defend against craving from a negative perspective, or trying to get something that it wants. Okay. So this is the reason that this idea of attachment and these aggregates is so critical. If your mind isn't collapsing down around something and holding on to it, attachment, clinging, and then moving into identification, what's happening is craving's happening. I mean, maybe a okay. So the question was, what is an illustration of how you could have craving without attachment? Okay. So I'll do the general, and then we'll try to fill it in. Okay. So like my mind wants something, and it hasn't collapsed down to the point of wanting it or desiring it to the degree that it has begun to mobilize any of its resources to get it. Okay, so I'm sitting in a restaurant, and this is an actual illustration. Okay, so I'm in a restaurant the other night with my family, and I'm having a nice meal. Okay, like, and I'm enjoying the meal. All right, so a waiter comes by with this really beautiful looking dish, and my daughter says, "Geez, I wonder what that is," you know, and we all look at it, and I mean, it looks really delicious, you know. And so you know, you could feel your mind moving out, you know. It's not just like a neutral observation, like, "Oh gee, that's really attractive," but like, it came right by. You saw it, you had the sensory experience, you smelled it, you could feel moving out with the desire or the craving, like, right? But I'm sitting here having this lovely dish, and this dish and the experience I was having was sufficiently compelling for all of my senses that, you know, I didn't go, geez, you know, I didn't start thinking about that, or I didn't start thinking, geez, the next time I'm here, it was just like, came by, it's gone, right? It's just like thought comes into your mind, moves through your mind, and your mind doesn't grab onto that thought. Okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can have like an aversive thought come into the mind, and depending on the strength of it, you know, maybe your mind immediately grabs onto it and does something with it. Okay, attachment. Okay. Sometimes an unpleasant thought will come into the mind, and it doesn't have enough charge, and it just floats through. So, and this is all, and those, this idea of doesn't have sufficient charge for me is significant because I understand practice from an energetic perspective. So, in a meditative process, we're not experiencing or contemplating ideas, we're experiencing experiences, sensations in our body, and we can feel exactly what I just described. You can be in meditation and a thought from the past can come up and it, you can feel it take you over. Some traumatic experience, a doorway opens up, and man, and it's like, I wonder if this is going to leave before the end of the sitting, or maybe this day or this week. And there are other things that will come up from the past that used to be really significant, and it'll come up and your mind will go to it and you'll just see that there's not much charge on it anymore, you know, because of the work you've done or time or what have you. And other thoughts will come up and you'll actually see it. It's not neutral, but you'll actually see it. You'll see that it's negative or positive, but your mind doesn't have any urge to do something, you know. So craving has a lot to do with this instinctive urge. I mean, you can actually feel it, you know, like to move. Here I am, I'm sitting here, and I'm balanced and minding my own business. And I see something, the meal, I hear something, I think a thought, and you can actually feel in your body moving out of this balanced place, that there is this urge to engage it. Okay. And then that urge can have a certain level of intensity. Okay. It can be way, way, way back at the beginning, where that urge is a feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This instinctive thing that happens at the moment of contact. And then that can ramp up to, immediately, we know this, to wanting something or not wanting something, right? And or it can be much stronger than that. You know, that topic or remembrance comes up, and your mind immediately either clamps down in opposing something or clamping down in the sense of trying to grab onto it because you want it or your mind wants it. And then it's just a question of intensity from there to identification. So,
okay. I have a different than your example of craving and attachment, attachment which can lead to suffering. And so I have a craving, I have a urge, a desire to be loved, to be accepted. And I don't mean by myself, to myself, but from others. Very strong urge. So much so that without it, I feel like I'm nothing.
You feel like you're?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Or nobody.
Without the urge?
Without the love.
Without the love.
And so what I have found in this practice is that that love which I craved, which I desire, is already present. And I don't have to, I don't need to, and I hope that I don't want to do anything for that love to be present. And in knowing this and accepting that that love doesn't have to come from the external, meaning you or from something or someone, that it's already present. So now there is no attachment. There might still be craving and there might still be attachment. But the knowing that that love is already present frees me from suffering.
Well, this is an important point, okay? Because where we're going with these five aggregates is you're talking about a kind of knowing that is at the core of what this sutta is talking about. You know, this sutta is not an informational sutta. There are some suttas that are basically informational or laying out information. This is an instructional manual, and it's an instructional manual about acquiring a certain kind of knowledge or a certain kind of knowing, and it's transformational knowing. It's knowing that is not intellectual, it's not conceptual, it's something that you know to be true based on your experience, and in this case, through a meditative process. And you see it and experience it over and over again in a certain way, at a certain depth, that you then have insight or transformational knowing, which you know to be true. And you know, somebody can tell you, I could say to you now, well, that's just a theory. You know, the fact that love is available I don't agree with that, and it'd have no effect on you because the way that you reported that, you know that to be true. So this kind of knowing, this deep knowing that is arising from this deep contemplative or meditative experience, is at the core of this practice, as opposed to intellectual knowing and experience. The intellectual part is very important because it provides a framework to help us understand a lot of our experiences. But that only gets you so far, okay? You know, the whole package is the two of them. And the Buddha, in this case, says, until I directly knew four things about these five aggregates, I did not have a firm foothold in the Dharma, which is a pretty extraordinary statement. So, so this is a thank you for saying that, because it's a good jumping off point, because I was saying, I was thinking about this topic and I was enjoying it so much that I forgot to use the poem that was the beginning of my talk that relates to what you just said, I think. So this is from Jay Krishnamurti, who the Indian sage, and it's entitled The True Meaning of Happiness. So he says, to find the true meaning of happiness, we must explore the river of self-knowledge. Every drop of water, every experience, every drop of water from the beginning to the end makes a river. To imagine we will find happiness at the source of the river is mistaken. To imagine we will find happiness at the source of the river is mistaken. It is to be found where you are on the river of self-knowledge. So, just another way of saying what the Buddha said over and over again about moment-to-moment non-judgmental awareness. You know, the only place we can wake up is right now, and it's cumulative. You know, the drops of the river, you know, come together to make a river, and then it's not the source, it's not back there where we're going to find happiness. We're going to find it here in understanding the experience that we're having. And I think there's so much talk of suffering in Buddhism that sometimes that we forget that what liberation is about a profound sense of happiness and satisfaction. And what is unique about it is that it is not a form of happiness or satisfaction that is arising from clinging or identification. All happiness that arises from clinging and from identification is in some way constricted or reaching out to get more. It is not balanced and centered in the moment. So by definition, it's temporary. And it has an intensity to it that doesn't allow it to be settled. So the kind of happiness that we're talking about is really a different kind of happiness. It's a different kind of satisfaction. So rather than arising as part of clinging and identification, it's arising from freedom from clinging and identification. And as a result, that allows us to be with the experience right now in this very pure, open, unconstricted way. It allows us to see what is present for what it actually is. It allows us to see our relationship to it for exactly what it is, rather than through a lens of clinging or identification. It allows us to appreciate it and appreciate its preciousness, because the way that we're viewing it isn't through a constricted lens of attachment and identification. You know, by definition, clinging and attachment take, you know, if it's the room, it shrinks it down, narrows it down, and grabs onto something. So, we're just by the nature of awareness, we're missing so much to begin with, okay? But with clinging and attachment, then it really narrows it down and then colors the entire thing. Okay, so what were the four things that the Buddha said we could work with this? That might be helpful. Okay. And how might we do it? So that's what I'd like to talk about. So the Buddha said, until I knew these five things, form, consciousness, perception, and feeling, all which arise simultaneously with this contact of a sense object and a mental formation, until I knew those directly through direct experience, not conceptually, I didn't have a foothold in the Dharma, and I did not declare myself to be liberated or awakened. Sounds pretty important. And the four things are actually really, really simple, as in the end, almost all of Buddhist practice is, because it's experiential about what's happening in this moment. So it can't get too complex, because it's one experience at a time. Okay. So the four things are, the Buddha said, is, and let's take an illustration. Let's take consciousness of a seeing, sight. Okay, so I see something. Seeing consciousness arises. It's obviously taking place in my body. There's a perception of what is seen. There's a feeling tone with it, and depending on when it is, there is or is not a feeling. You know, I see someone that I like in the back of the room. And, you know, I'm talking, right? And I'm involved in my talk. And I look and I notice that person is back there and I didn't realize they were there. I have an experience right in that moment of the feeling tone of that sensory contact of seeing that person. Okay. So let's start with that. So he said, well, there's four things. He said the first thing is, well what is the origin of that? And the second one is, well, basically, is it true that there's a feeling tone? And the third one is, well, what is the cessation? Is it true that it ends? And how does it end? And then, based on your seeing of those three things, how would you train your mind to slowly unwind, loosen the grip of attachment and identification? So those are the four things, okay? So let's take an illustration. So I think we can practice with this in two ways. The first way is meditatively. in the meditation process itself, which when you read these suttas, you realize that you need to have some ability to pay attention and hold your attention on experience to begin to see at this level. You know, there's some of it we can do in daily life, but it's just going to be catch as catch can. You know, so the second type, which is kind of thinking back about your experience, you know, tracking things back, is a supplement and a support of the meditative practice. But this absolutely is a meditative based practice, sitting meditation. Okay. So since our eyes aren't open during sitting meditation, let's say that there's a sound or a recollection comes up. And so in this first area of well, what is the origin? This sounds so ridiculously simple that it almost doesn't sound like anything. But then when I say it, just reflect for a moment and see if in the sitting tonight, if it a single time, once in the 45-minute sitting, you had this recognition, okay? So I'm sitting here and I hear something or I have a recollection, and the origin of the consciousness, the perception, and the feeling tone is that moment of contact. Now, most of the time, we go right by that and we're into the experience of whatever it is. You know, we are into the perception, or we're into the feeling, or we're into a reaction to the perception or the feeling. So, you know, you hear a sound and it's a pleasant sound and it's soothing, and that stimulates the thought of another soothing thing, and there's a chain reaction, or it's a negative. And rather than actually seeing the arising of negative consciousness, you have a negative reaction to it. So you're already up past clinging. You're past identification. Okay? So you can hear from that in something so simple how quickly this whole process just runs through your mind, because it's so embedded, it's so deep. Okay. So what we're actually looking for is the arising of the experience, and we're looking to answer the experiential question, is it true that consciousness arises with contact? Or does it arise some other way? Now, I'm sure everybody in the room has an intellectual answer to that. But asking yourself, you know, do I actually have like a deep experiential answer to that question? So it's, well, is it true that consciousness arises with contact? Is it true, experientially true, for each of us to find out that perception arises at the moment of contact? Is it true that a feeling arises at the moment of contact? And then what are the implications of that? You know, what are the consequences of that? And not in an intellectual way, but just watching it. I mean, it's a profound thing. If that's true, it's extraordinarily profound. And it's particularly profound in the sense of the possibility of being liberated from suffering. Because if we actually started watching and knew the answer to those questions about the origin of those things and knew them to be true or false, we would have to be doing some fairly sophisticated being with our experience to begin to see those things consistently. And it would change our understanding of experience. Because normally where we are is all the way down on the other end. We're on the other side of clinging and attachment most of our life. Most of the time, we're working to be mindful of being on the other side, that we are reactive, that we are experiencing something. You know, we're in the 10th, 15th, 20th, 30th generation of an experience. That's where our mindfulness is. So here we're talking about something that can only be done, I think, in sitting meditation and just being with experience over and over and over again, and just seeing, hearing, listening, feeling, and trying to keep our attention at this fundamental, most fundamental level of experience arising. So if we actually knew, I mean, in the way that, I don't want to mention names, but here in the front row, you know, we're saying, well, I know that this is available, that this is true. I mean, if we knew that about the answer to these questions, it would radically change our understanding of our suffering. Because most of our suffering is attached with a narrative. And you would see that where the suffering actually is coming from is back at these very fundamental things, including the mental formation which is attached to the narrative. So it opens up a radically different possibility of how we would deal with suffering. So that would be, you know, the origin. So the second one about feeling tone, it's like, well, you know, I said, is it true that feeling tone arises with contact? And then is it true that it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? And what do those things mean? And is it true that that colors experience and tends to point the mind in a certain direction? Because that's the whole game with feeling or feeling tone, is that it colors the experience, and if we don't see that, then it points the mind someplace, and it points it towards craving, which points it towards clinging, which points it towards identification. So, just once again, you know, just sitting with something that, you know, most of the time we see something and we want to change that, we want to fix it, we don't want that experience, whatever it is. You know, it's a fundamental urge of the mind. Well, it's like one of the first big tasks to practice like this is to overcome that urge, to exercise restraint. It's like, no, I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to sit here and have the experience and watch it and feel it and listen to it as deeply as I possibly can in this context. And then the third element about cessation, like, you know, once again, I mean, this question is so preposterously simple, and it's so profound. Okay. Like, is it true that, is it true that hearing consciousness ends when there is no longer contact between the sense door of my ear and that vibration? Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, if you can't hear it physically, then you're absolved from
it. You're
absolved from getting upset about it.
Well, see, and this goes kind of to the issue, right? Because, so, let's say that it is true that hearing consciousness is no longer present once my ear is no longer in contact with that, and that my perception of that experience, of this experience, is no longer there, and the feeling tone is now past. If that's all true. But we're still left with something. Well, what is that? And what caused it? See, now we tend to think, our mind just automatically defaults to the idea that, well, we heard this and we started thinking something, and, well, whatever it is, okay, I'm suffering or I'm enjoying it. But we're diving down below that idea, because there's a difference between my experiencing pleasure right now in this moment, in the moment of contact, and the moment of contact is over, and I'm still experiencing pleasure. I'm not experiencing pleasure of this contact with my ear anymore. So what is that? What is that pleasure? Okay, this is called discernment, that we actually begin to understand the differences in the experiences that we're having and why we're having them. And the experience after the sensory contact, if this is left, has something to do with the sensory contact of an idea in my mind. And to see that, and then to ask the same exact questions. Is it true that the idea contacted my mind, and it just keeps going? But it's having this raw, most fundamental understanding of our experience, which leads to our ability to understand our experience in a new way and to relate to it in a new way, a way that is not based on clinging and identification. If I could actually see these things, I see that the issue actually is a process that's taking place. And there is a origin of the process, and there's a cessation of the process. So then the Buddha's fourth thing, you know, like, well, how would you train your mind to diminish and ultimately eliminate the suffering around these issues, would all arise from those initial experiences. It's not a new question. You would intuitively see it, because you would see that where the suffering is coming from is from not seeing these initial things. And by not seeing these initial things, we cling and identify, and then we suffer. So unless we figure out how to get under, behind, whatever, however you want to conceptualize it, clinging and identification, we can never get free of suffering in a long-term sense. We make a lot of progress on a short-term sense, but never get free on a long-term sense. And what the Buddha wanted us to do was see deeply and actually get free, and then begin to experience satisfaction and happiness that is not based on clinging or identification. So I think if you want to try this, and I'm very clear that this is whether this sounds interesting or attractive to you as a practice will have a lot to do with where you are on the path, you know, your ripeness for certain kinds of practices. We're all different personalities, we're all at different stages. Maybe in this lifetime this never sounds attractive. Maybe you hear something in this instinctively, immediately. You know, your mind recognizes how profound and how powerful it could be. If you could even get a small little foothold in this, that it would be worth trying. So if you'd want to, like, try this, what I would suggest is start with your meditation practice, and it's obvious that even to start training your mind to watch this way, the first thing that you would actually have to do, I think, is like conceptually memorize these questions, so that when you're sitting down to do it, you're not suddenly thinking about what it is you're supposed to be looking for. Okay? I mean, that you've actually thought it through. Okay, that I'm going to be looking for contact, or as close to contact as I get. You know, I'm going to be experientially looking for, is it true, the consciousness arises? Or is there some other element that causes consciousness? Is it true that perception arises and distinguishes? Is it, you know, each one of these things? And what are the consequences of that? So that you can actually try to do that without having to think about it. That's the first thing I do. Next thing I do is I would take maybe the middle of my sitting. So you're going to have your concentration or your ability to pay attention fairly stable to try to do this. So however long that takes you, okay. But if you, like, you're sitting for 45 minutes, right in the middle of that, I would say do 15 minutes of this, where you just open up. You're not going to try to resolve anything. If you're annoyed, you're going to appreciate it, because it's going to be an opportunity to do this rather than figure out how not to be annoyed. And so just for 15 minutes, do this. And not bring too much judgment about progress with you, because you will find that at the beginning of doing this, and probably for a number of weeks, you will find this difficult to do. You'll feel like you're not getting it. You know, it's like there's no momentum, it's not happening. And then somewhere in there, you will have one of these experiences. And you will have a sense of how important they are, and that will make you go back. I mean, the hook will be in your mouth. So that's what you're trying to do, is just stay with this. Not trying to make something happen, just watching, waiting to receive this experience, and then at some point, you'll have one of these, and then it'll provide an incentive to go back and do it. So that's the first part I would do, and then the second part is, I would actually reflect on the experience that you have, and I'm sure you've heard in a number of talks of different versions of reflecting on your experience and then kind of tracing back the elements of reactivity. Well, you can do some of that with this in that same way. And it is trying to look at your experience and then conceptually frame it and work back with it. I think what's important is just to realize that doing that isn't the experience itself. And not to get confused about that's not what you're trying to do. You're trying to reflect on the experience itself from a conceptual standpoint. And that by itself isn't going to be this practice. If you don't have the experiential base to work with, trying to conceptualize this with some daily life experience, it may be valuable from understanding reactivity. It won't be this experience, because this experience is so fundamental. Okay. So, let's see. I think you had a question. Yeah.
I did. Sorry, backtrack.
No, not at all.
What is the origin of that? So, does that? Do you mean, what is the origin of that as to which of the aggregates?
Well,
which sense storm?
The inquiry is of one of the aggregates. And so with consciousness, from a Buddhist perspective, five senses, and consciousness arises at the moment of contact. That's what we are told. Okay, so this is an inquiry into experientially the truth of that teaching. Is that unclear? It seems like, well, gee, that sounds simple, and then it's like your mind wants to go, well, there must be something else, or it can't be that simple, and that's the whole point. because to see that your mind is doing that. And so the practice is that in meditation, to actually watch for this, and then without trying to make something happen, just staying present and watching, and then learning experientially about the nature of consciousness and perception and feeling.
So the awareness of it, or that contact, that initial contact or awareness of it, I wonder if there's another word for origin.
We could say the beginning. The word isn't what's important. What we're looking at is, when does consciousness arise? Okay? And you could say, when does it begin? When does it start? How does that happen? There is some experience where that starts, right? The Buddha said that it's at this moment of contact. And if it's true, it's like a big deal. Okay? So like if we could experientially sit with that enough to know that to be true or false, and to know that it's not some other way. Our mind wants to say, well, I have to think about that. I'm not sure if it's at the point, right? Well, your mind doesn't need to do that anymore because it's had this direct experience of that, and it knows the answer experientially. So your mind will not go there. Your mind is not going to go into an experience, an intellectual inquiry, conceptual inquiry, if it has had this transformational knowing.
Okay.
That it already knows this at a level which is far deeper than a conceptual or intellectual level. Okay. So I think there's probably another 45 minutes that I was going to talk about. So there's time for, and I'm not going to do it. So if there's more discussion or a few questions and answers,
Margaret. We
got a little time for that.
Margaret.
Yes,
okay. I don't think I have a grasp on volitional
formation. Okay. All right. So, sometimes I wish that I don't like, I think it would be better just to use the Pali term, so then there's no association with it at all, right? Yeah. And so I think traditionally there are, I forget, I don't know if it's 47 or 57, or there's a traditional chart of what these formations are and how they come about. I think for shorthand and the way that we're teaching it in the West is to think of this as very, very deep and embedded habits of mind. So that end up coloring our experience, and they can do it at a very low level, where you hear a new sound and it in some way is similar to a sound that you've experienced before that is pleasant, so it just has this low-level pleasantness to it, or the reverse. Or it could be a habit of mind that has become very ingrained, and it has to do with your understanding of the world. That the world is not a safe place, or that people are not safe. So that just being placed in the right circumstance, that goes into full bloom at the moment of contact. I mean, there's no rolling out. I mean, there's consciousness, perception, feeling, tone, clinging, attachment, identification, and suffering that is big time suffering in an instant. Okay, and where that's coming from is from this deeply embedded experience that has not been purified or cleared or resolved, whatever language we want to use. The Buddha actually framed it by saying that we have these knots of these things in our body and in our mind, and that what we're trying to do, the work, is to unknot those. Okay, so that's one of the analogies. There's purification analogies. But it's basically that both in the body and the mind, there's these things that are embedded that, given the right conditions, will blossom instantaneously into clinging and identification and suffering. So then you can kind of reflect, well, just think about, well, what is it that like will really set you off quickly and make you suffer, you know? I mean, one night, I think, shortly after the election, you know, we just did this thing of saying names, you know, to make this point. So, okay, close your eyes, you know, get calm, and, you know, you say one name, and people don't even have a reaction to it. They don't even know who the person is, so, yeah, they have a reaction, you know, and then you say a name, Mother Teresa. You know, and even with your eyes open, it's kind of, most people have kind of this little positive opening experience, and then, you know, Saddam Hussein, you know, and then you start mentioning political figures. But you can see it's not subtle. It's like, boom. I mean, there's this, you are moving out of this neutral place or balanced place here into some form of pleasant or unpleasant, usually much more intense than that, right? So is this helpful at all?
Yeah, just have it resonates.
Okay.
But you're right. The Western term for volition, I was trying to figure out where our will is.
Okay. So, and thank you for asking that. So the reason that volition, sometimes it's called just mental formation. And sometimes it's called volitional formation. The reason that volitional is there is that if I believe this frequently, I don't recognize it because I'm so identified with it. But if I believe that the world is an unsafe place, or that I can't trust myself, or you know, the number of things that I could say that are not uncommon things for people to have, okay? Given the right circumstances, I will act in a certain way, and it drives my intention in that moment. Because if I believe that I can't trust myself or I can't trust you, my intention is to protect myself or protect myself from you, right? So the big ones, you know, these big mental forms, have an element in them that drives our intention off of the formation. Okay.
Yes. I hear the word awareness both of the mind and the brain, hearing, seeing, feeling, touching, and also acceptance, because there is rejection and there is acceptance. In the rejection, there is the attachment, then the suffering. In the acceptance, there is an opportunity to not only bring awareness, but to bring about an end to the suffering.
I think that the notion of acceptance is one of the greatly underemphasized elements of our practice. And what, in this context, what I mean by acceptance, if I'm unwilling to sit unconditionally with unpleasant experiences, I will never learn how to do anything other than control my reactivity. That's all I'll learn how to do. I will never understand unpleasant experiences and how to deal with them skillfully. And if I don't agree with the political situation that's going on right now, a bunch of stuff that's going on, if I'm unwilling to accept the absolute undeniable truth that there are a certain people, a group of people in control who believe a certain set of things, and they're going to act on them, and that's going to happen, whether I like it or not, I will never figure out how to be, you know, have any sense of equanimity about the situation, so then I can decide how to act skillfully to whatever action those people take. So this notion of acceptance is, I mean, so fundamental, and I mean, I honestly, I mean, how often do we hear in Dharma talks anything about acceptance? Mm-hmm. We don't hear it very much. And I think if you don't have an understanding of that, and it's a fundamental part of your daily life and your meditation practice, I think there's only so far you can get, because you're being impeded in the same way that if my sense of happiness is through a prism of clinging and identification, that is inherently limiting. And if my understanding of the way to work with what I don't agree with, that I find negative, is to be negative about it and then do something about it, that inherently restricts my ability just to engage it in a healthy way. It automatically cuts off all kinds of way of seeing, of understanding, of brainstorming, all of everything. And of course, it's absolutely against our fundamental urge. We don't want to accept what we don't like, what we find unpleasant, what we find aversive. That's the reason that craving and what I just described is the second noble truth and the ultimate origin. So for me, the second noble truth, the biggest thing that comes off of that is the notion of acceptance. That I've got to be willing to sit unconditionally with whatever is there in daily life or in meditation as the fundamental basis for my practice.
Sometimes I think we get something in our brain confuses acceptance with condoning.
Or acquiescence, all kinds of things. Yeah. And of course, every time you mention anything about, you know, somebody who's been exploited, you know, financially, economically, sexually, power dynamics, whatever it may be, that's the first thing that starts to come up, you know, that, and you can hear that I'm not talking about that.
Right.
You know, in that context, I mean, my belief is, I'm not going to go into my personal narrative, but, you know, I have some dynamics that I'm still dealing with about a certain kind of abuse. And my willingness, and this takes, if it's serious, this is a lifetime of work. But the difference between my being able to, you know, really heal from it, as opposed to manage it or cope with it, has to do with my willingness to be unconditionally with it. And that word unconditional is the key word. That's what defines acceptance. Okay? And it's like, well, I can accept it to this level. Yeah, you know. So it's a challenge, and it's a doorway. Like most of this stuff in practice, you know, is on one side of it, it's a challenge, and the other side is a doorway, just over and over and over again with these practices. So, okay.
I think that energy has a lot to do with what we're talking about, and where are we channeling our energy? And so in rejection, there is a lot of energy. In acceptance, There's energy, but a different kind of energy. So where are we channeling our energy? And how is that energy bringing about healing or more suffering?
That's exactly right. Yeah, and the way the Buddha framed that is what we do with our attention, because there's our attention manifests itself in a bunch of different ways, but it all flows through where we are focusing our attention. So that's exactly right. Okay, well, thank you all very much for coming. I hope that this was helpful. And just may all of us in the world we live in, I think the world that we're living in right now, in this particular moment, because of a bunch of different dynamics, really needs a lot of understanding and acceptance and kindness. And let's all try to extend that to ourselves and to everyone around us, and see if we can lessen our suffering and the suffering around us in some little way every day. So, thank you very much.